Welcome, everybody. Thank you all very much for coming, and welcome back to spring semester. And I hope it's going to be a wonderful and fulfilling and enjoyable semester for everybody, replete with lots of academic success and lots of social good stuff, and also lots of Limud Torah, hopefully. So that should be a blessing for all of us. Right. That is obviously the definition of social. Thank you, Gabe. I appreciate that. okay, so this is my first piece of learning that during this semester. So great to be here. Let me introduce what we're going to do this evening, and hopefully what we'll be doing for a good part of this semester. Shabbat just gone was Parashat Shemot, the beginning of the book of Shemot, Exodus. And the semester more or less ends, at least, you know, by the time you get to the end of it, it's true finals time with Pesach. And so it seemed to me a good opportunity to find some time to really, you say in Hebrew, ma'amik, to really go in depth on the book of Shemot. Now, partly this is a hangover from last semester, as I might have mentioned to some of you. If you've just arrived, don't be embarrassed to go and get food, and don't worry about that. A hangover from last semester, where I had like withdrawal symptoms from not giving a weekly Parsha Shir on Bereshit, and sort of like feeling like my appreciation of Bereshit was therefore lacking in contrast to the previous year. But so it's sort of to do with that. But it's also more fundamentally connected to Shemot. And that is, without a doubt, Bereshit is the most famous book in the Torah, which has got the most memorable stories, the stories which we go back over and back over. And for that reason, I think Shemot sometimes gets a little bit underplayed. It gets it gets missed out somewhat. At the heart of Sefer Shemot is obviously the story of She'abud Mitzrayim, the slavery in Egypt, and then Yitziat Mitzrayim. Without a doubt, this is the most important individual story in the Torah, in the Tanakh. It's just a very simple way of explaining that. Yitziat Mitzrayim is referenced. Anybody want to guess how many other times in Tanakh, meaning outside of Sefer Shemot, how many times is Yitziat Mitzrayim referred to? Any guesses? In the Bible as a whole, 24 books of the Bible. So not including Bereshit, obviously, not including Shemot, so 22 books of the Bible. Any guesses as to how much Yitziat Mitzrayim is referenced? If the word Yitziah appears, I'm not counting that. I mean, how many times is the story referred back to? Throw out ideas.
52.
52?
613.
Twice.
Very good, twice. Okay, so I have this statistic from my teacher, Dr. Yael Ziegler. She claims at a very, very minimum it is referenced 60 times throughout Tanakh, right? I mean, if you think...
Is that like a
Gematria? Right, Ravi was pretty close.
Is that like a symbolism? Like Gematria, like 60?
Yeah. I'm going to give you that task of working that out. But it's referenced more than any other story, right? You could give a whole fascinating shir on Yitziat Mitzrayim in the book of Amos, the way in which the prophet Amos looked back at Yitziat Mitzrayim. So is it an important story? Obviously, it's absolutely critical. And it should go without saying, it's not just critical for us as Jews, as those who are committed to and lovers of the Torah. It's arguably one of the most important stories in world history, right? It was... you know, look at so many critical moments, at least in the Western world, where fundamental sort of like moves forward have been done through looking back at the biblical story of Yitziat Mitzrayim and sort of seeing themselves as a continuation of that story. And so one can't overestimate its significance. Having said all that, when it comes to actually feeling that I really knew what was going on in the book of Shemot, even just in the first half of Shemot, I have to say that for many years I felt I didn't really get it. Like it was like the story didn't progress in a clear way for me. It seemed to have like a lot of start-stop points where you seemed to go back on a lot of things. And it wasn't until a few years ago when I was asked to teach a few classes on Shemot, and as I mentioned to Pinchas this morning, the best way ever to learn something is to teach something. It wasn't until putting those classes together that I thought I was able to really get some sort of coherence and ideas within within Shemot. So that's to broadly say what I want to try and do with the learning this semester, which isn't to say, obviously, that if you miss a class, a couple of classes, means that you're out of it. Definitely, definitely not. Each class also stands alone. But I hope that between now and Pesach, we should have amassed a really good amount of material on Sefer Shemot, so that when it comes to Leila Seder, when it comes to every time that you revisit the story, you really feel you haven't just got a few cute ideas that you've heard over there. You've really got an in-depth appreciation of the text. So why not? Let's open up, just symbolically, even if we're not going to look at the verses right now, to the beginning of Shemot. Shemot chapter 1, which is page 292. All right, let's also do a little bit of methodology. Whenever we begin to study a new book of Tanakh, what are the critical questions that we need to ask ourselves, right? You can't just start reading and go. What are the things that we want to sort of put out there? Any suggestions? Avi?
What's the connection between the last one and this one?
Very, very good. How does this specific book of the Torah, of the Tanakh, fit into the context as a whole and to what has come before? Very good. What else? No wrong answers here, right? Don't be shy. What are the questions? Whenever we start learning a new book of Tanakh, what are the critical questions that we want to ask ourselves before really beginning to begin our study? But we assume we don't just start reading a book, right? What are the questions we want to put out there?
What point in time is it?
Very good. What point in time?
Historically,
very good. So I can sort of actually take that in two directions. What point in time is when does the book occur? When does it feature?
Are the Jewish people are they in the land of Israel? Are they outside of the land?
Geographical location critical to it. But to take your first point in an interesting direction, not just where does it fit into the broader span of biblical history, but also what's the internal timeline to the book? How long does the book take? Right, and this is such a simple point, but like sometimes a lot of times people don't, until it's sort of spelled out, people don't get it. Not every page of the Bible, not every chapter of the Tanakh takes up an equal amount of time. Right? People thought of that? I mean, let's just like give some simple examples, okay? How many years is the book of Bereshit? Sorry?
2000.
It's in the millenniums, right? It's more than 2000, okay? How many, but of that, the majority is chapters 1 to chapters 11. From the time of Abraham, chapter 11, it is about four generations. How long is the book of Devarim? Give or take, right? We're not quite sure, but about that. How long is the book of Bamidbar?
40 years.
38 years, if I'm going to nitpick, but it's very good. How long is the book of Vayikra? 8 days, right? So everyone's... And then, you know, okay, how long is the book of Shoftim?
A lot.
At least 400 years, right? How long is the book of Yehoshua? 24 years, right? And all of these books, all the ones that I've mentioned, are more or less exactly the same size, right? None of them are more than... now they're all in the sort of the 25 to 40 chapter range for the... For the most part, right? So what you see from this is that, you know, even within a book, you want to think about the timeline very much. Okay, any other questions?
This might be more like at the end of reading it, but like what's significant to the title before reading it? Or I don't know if that's also important.
Very, very good. In fact, that's exactly what we're going to come to. And connected to that, in fact, let's even jump straight in with that. Really, what is the theme of the book, right? What is the message of the book, right? Rav Liebtag, who I think just confirmed today we'll be having later on in the semester, always had a very, very sharp way of sort of presenting Tanakh. What's the classical difference in newspaper writing is that the front pages are the news, right? The front pages are... Word beginning with C, he used for it.
Current events.
If you like, yeah. description of the events. Let's call it the news. The middle pages are the opinion section. Okay? What's the Tanakh? Is it the front of the newspaper or is it the middle of the newspaper? Is it just telling us events or is it telling us what to think about the events?
Or is it both?
Well, what do we think? Without a doubt, it's a mixture of both. Right? So connected to your, to expanding your idea, Michael, of what is the name of the book, that also connects to what is the theme, not just what are the events being told about them, but what are the lessons and the messages that are coming out of it. So let's take a sheet and pass around and see on if you go in that direction. And what I want to start with really is exactly Michael's question of the name of the book. And what can the name of the book show us about the theme of the book? Okay, so I want to start with something which will surprise all of you. The Bahag, Baal Hilchot Gdolot, one of the very important early halach, post-Talmudic halachic works, one of the Gaonim, he counts the books of the Torah as follows. Everybody ready for this? Chamisha Chumshei Torah. This is what he says. There are five books of the Torah. There is Sefer Bereshit. There is Chumash Sheni. Sefer Kohanim, Vayikra, Chumash Pekudim, Bamidbar, Umishnah Torah, Mishnah Torah, Devarim. Everybody see that? He gives the classic names that the sages, the Talmudic names for each of the books of the Tanakh, and what does he call of the Torah, and what does he call Shmot? The second book. Right? The second one. Does everyone see how funny that is? Right? Every book has got its own name, right? Bereshit is the beginning. Vayikra is about the Kohanim. Bamidbar is about the censuses. Devarim is Mishneh Torah, the repetition of what is important to take from the Torah. And what is Shemot? It's the second book, right? Come on, let's tease this out. Let's unpack this. What's funny about this? What's weird about it?
You should have said, like, separate Yom Yisrael or something. You should have said something.
Is Sefer Shemot so empty of themes that you couldn't give it a great name, right? Just to call it number two? Megan?
Well, it's also, like, it's a continuation of Bereshit from, like, where it left off almost exactly, because we literally just ended up with, like, I forgot what we ended up with, like, before, but, I mean, like, Yaakov died, and now we're up to the point where, like, Yosef and all the, like, that whole generation starts up with them dying, so, like, it's almost a continuation of Sefer Bereshit in that sense, whereas, like, a lot of, like, the future, like, Chumashim, like, are jumping forward or going backwards or just repeating things that already happened.
So I think that Megan is spot on that what wasn't that the Bahag would have struggled to think of an exciting story and Sefer Shemot to give it a name, but what he wants to say is you should read Sefer Shemot as a continuation of Bereshit. I think that's...
Then why are they two separate sperm?
Can I ask a question? Maybe this is silly, but doesn't the Chumash refer to all of the five, like, books?
What do you mean? Oh, well, we say Chumash to mean Chumash, the five books, yes, but he says each one is one, he calls one. Each one a book, yeah. Marco, sorry?
You said why isn't that one book? Why
yeah, so then why isn't it one book if it's a continuation?
Same thing.
And also, he jumps right to Chumash Sheni, but he doesn't say what the first one is. Like, you could say it's Bereshit, right.
He says Bereshit.
No, he says Bereshit, and the second Chumash.
Sefer Bereshit, the Chumash Sheni.
I know, but do you know what I'm saying?
No.
I'm saying it's not like Chumash Rishon and Chumash Sheni.
Right, the first one has got it.
Everyone has a name.
Except the second one. That makes it all the more weird.
Still, that's what I know. Another thing that's weird. That,
right.
That was from the original
right.
question of what's weird.
Ah, okay.
That was weird.
Right, agreed. So,
sorry.
It's all right. Malka and I have been a shiur together. This is really advanced part of it. So, that's the Bahag. That apparently, I mean, let's just take this as an interesting level. You shouldn't see what's the overall theme that you should see in Sefer Shemot. You should see the continuation of Bereshit, right? That Sefer Shemot should be read as what comes straight after Bereshit. You shouldn't want Marcus says, okay, so why isn't it one book? I don't know. It's not one book. Why isn't Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet one book?
It is.
Well, yeah, there you go. They ran it. I mean, what's the answer? Anybody know?
I think
the answer is that parchments in those days were not so long that you could have put Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet in a single book. But Shmuel Aleph ends halfway through a story, basically, in which Shmuel Bet begins. Maybe, who knows? If he would have said that.
Call it
Bereshit Sheni.
If like it's the continuation of the first.
I'm not quite sure, but the thing that really jumps out is view it as a continuation. Fascinating, very very interesting. Igal.
You can say that like since it's referenced so much, we have like a whole holiday about Yetziat Mitzrayim, and like we say it every day, people would think it's more important. So it's kind of like to counteract the perception of what most people would think. Sort of like how Sfardim sit during Aseret HaDibro when we read it from the Torah, because it's not more important than the rest.
Some Sfardim.
Okay.
Right. Interesting. So it's as in. So what you're saying is actually, it jumps out at you more than any other book in terms of what the themes are. And so in order that you don't sort of give it undue reverence, it plays it down. Very interesting, Daphne.
Maybe it's like Toy Story 1 and Toy Story 2. If you made Toy Story 2 a whole different movie, it is a different story, but it has kind of like the same characters and the same themes in a way, so if you would have named it something else, people wouldn't have made the connection.
Mm.
When you name it Toy Story 2, people who like Toy Story 1 would be like, I'm going to go see Toy Story 2. And it doesn't take, I mean, it is a separate story, but it doesn't, like, take anything away. And, like, I mean, movies do it all the time.
That's very intriguing, but then you'd ask, why is it not Toy Story 3, 4, and 5 as well? Why do all of them merit their own name?
Right.
With the exception
well,
of this
Sefer
one.
Well, Sefer Kohanim is a different, you can argue it's, like, a little bit of a different theme.
Right, right. Okay. Michelle? And then we'll move
there's
on.
There's too much going on in Shmuel.
Right.
I mean, if you call it Sefer Yetziat Mitzrayim, there's also Matan
Torah. Very, very good. That's a very, very interesting answer. As in...
too many things.
Right, right.
Can't,
it's lehefech of what we were... of the original thing that had been so, which is it's... you should just see it as the continuation. That's its main thing. As you're saying, it's sort of so overloaded with amazing stories. Okay.
We can say the same thing about Bresha too.
Bresha is so crowded that it's...
Yeah,
it gives it one name that, like, at least defines, like, it is the beginning. Like, you can't deny that.
Yeah.
But in Shmuel, you could say, like, well, what is it about? Like, it's about a place.
Why can't you call it the middle?
The either two-fifths. The irony is that...
Bresha actually the beginning?
The irony being that the Bahag seems to make it so unexciting, so uninteresting. Just Chumash Sheni. So...
right.
Whichever reason it is it that you should see it as a direct continuation? Is it that it's so full we can't give it? That's one there. What is it classically called by those who speak Hebrew? What's its name? The Book of Shemot. Shemot. Very, very good. What does Shemot mean? Shmois. Shmaus. That's how. Anyone have any friends from Manchester?
Shmaus.
No one ever had any friends from Manchester in. From Israel? Yeah, Shmaus. Shmaus. So Shmot. What is Shemot?
Names,
right? Where does that come from? Presumably it comes from rather than calling it Sefer Va'ele, which would be the first word of the book, which would sound a little bit strange, we go by the second, with the first noun in the book of Shemot is Shemot, Ve'ele Shemot B'nei Yisrael. Right, in the same way in which with Parshiot, right, the Parshiot, the names we give to each weekly portion doesn't seem to really represent the Parsha as a whole. We just go for the sort of like the first prominent word which jumps out at us. That would be one reading of the name Shemot. Anybody sort of like have a heavier reading? Is there something in the word Shemot which sums up the theme of the book, Avi?
Well, like Shemot, like comes from the word shame, and like shame's like more like Hashem, and like and then when it talks about shame, it's referring to shame Hashem, and therefore like this, that's what this whole book is about, like B'nai Yisrael's relationship with God, and God helping like get like their beginning of like B'nai Yisrael's relationship with them, and getting through Mitzrayim.
Very interesting. I would not have thought of that. Okay. Tess?
There's like the classic Midrash that when Bnei Israel were in Mitzrayim, right? They kept those three things, their body language and their clothes, right?
Okay.
So because Bnei Israel, like the fact
just as a quick aside, I don't mean this to, I really don't want to embarrass you at all with this, but many people, that famous Midrash is very frequently invoked, right? Everyone familiar with the Midrash that Tess mentions, right? What did Bnei Israel keep in Mitzrayim? Their names, their clothes, and
their language. Yeah.
There is no such midrash.
What, really?
Not only is there no such midrash, there's no such Rashi.
Where did it come from?
right? Everyone says the famous Rashi. There's no such Rashi.
Probably someone right? who said something cutesy like that. Like you always.
Anybody know when it was put together for the first time?
It's the second grade Flemish play.
Hungary in the 18th century is where that those three appear for the first time. Not, I mean, each one appears by itself in a separate one, but the idea of the famous trio is a very, very. I think it was a student of the Chatham Sofer. There's a, I can send people a whole paper about it, which is fascinating. Sure. I didn't mean to. But no, each one appears separately. It's not that it was made up in the 18th century, they were run together. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Michael.
I guess going off that idea, but not the Medrash part, like the word Shemot, like your name is sort of like identifying who you are.
Mm-hmm.
You'll always
mm-hmm.
have that. And I think in the book of Shemot, like the Jewish people become, like have an identity, they become the Jewish people.
Right.
And I think that sort of embodies the book. It's Yofi. Sort of like from the beginning till the end, sort of how the Jewish people are being formed.
Yofi. So let's do our first little bit of learning, okay? And I want to sort of develop this idea that the name Shemot is not just, oh, it happens to be the first noun, the second word of the book, so we call it that. Rather, the name Shemot actually takes up something critical to the idea. The book of Shemot begins as follows. Ve'el Shemot b'nei Yisrael. Everybody have the place, the first Pasuk, page 292. These are the names of the children of Israel, Habaim, Mitzrayimah, that Jacob, Ish uveto bao, Jacob and all of his house came with him. And what do we have? For two psukim, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zebulun, Binyamin, three psukim, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher. Names. Names jumping out at us. And what are names? What does a name symbolize?
Identity.
Family.
Character. Family. Essence. History. Where you're from, right? You hear somebody's name, you say, oh, that's me. Can tell something about them, possibly your relatives, your ancestors, etc., etc., right? This is the group that come down, the family of Yaakov, this proud family with a tradition from Avraham and onwards, migrating to Egypt, and this is who comes down. Everybody turn to the beginning of chapter 2, Perek Bet. And tell me if you notice anything interesting in these verses. Vayelech ish mi beit Levi. A man went out from the house of Levi. Vayikach et bat Levi. And took, married, a daughter of the house of Levi. Vatahar ha'isha. And the woman became pregnant. Vatelet ben. She gave birth. Vatere oto. And she saw him. Ki tovu. Vatitz penehu shloshay achim. And she hid him for 3 months. What's absent?
Names.
Right? It's just, you know, if you take this, the basic idea in Tanakh, that a name shows you so much about a person, right? Avraham is Avhamon Goyim, the father of many nations. Yitzchak, laughter. Yaakov, Yisrael, etc., etc. People familiar with the drashot of the names. And what do you have here? You have got the complete absence of names. What's occurred between the first verses of the book, which are just full of names, and the beginning of the second chapter, which is absent of names, what's happened? Exactly, right? This proud family that has moved down to Egypt, a family that have been not only obviously financially independent and successful, but also bearing a proud tradition, have come under terrible persecution, have been enslaved by a foreign nation, are no longer able to have, whether it be the physical or the political or the spiritual, religious, cultural life that they used to. And how is that just summed up so powerfully? Their names are completely absent, right? They have no names whatsoever, right? This I sort of like imagine like it's black, right? Like as like if you were seeing this in a film, like, you know, the picture is grainy, there are no colours, you're not able to distinguish anything about the people. I mean, like, I just can't read that line, Vayelech Ishmi Beit Levi, and not see it in sort of like just a completely, you know, dark, painful environment in which just like the basics of life are taken away. Avi?
Well, you also look at it, that's like, because the first name that's like real name that's mentioned in this paragraph is Moshe. instead of being like dark, it's like more like a build up to like the Moshe is Hashem backwards according to Michael. He saw that. That was a good. I thought that was really
good work
cool.
Towards your gematria. Okay.
That's not great. But like, about, I don't know if Rashi says it, but like the reason that there's no names right now is that because like Moshe is like the first name that you want.
And who gives Moshe his name?
Bat Paro.
And what is the name Moshe? What's its? So that's the way in which we give. That's the way in which the Torah gives it. But well known that Moshe was an Egyptian name, right? Very interesting. The Am Yisrael at the beginning of the story are not able to give their own child a name. In fact, I mean, they've had to give up the child. So even the first name that does appear is actually an Egyptian name. Or a name. A, it's an Egyptian name, and it's given by an Egyptian. But there is a question which we've been discussing, a few of us in the Bet Midrash this week, which is that for those of us who have looked at this week's Parsha, at Parshat Va'era. Parshat Va'era begins, it's a good few weeks off in terms of our study, but it begins with Moshe and Aharon going to Paro and initially being unsuccessful, and Hashem responding. If you turn to Parshat Va'era, Hashem responding, "Don't worry, it's going to be okay." And then out of nowhere, right? If you turn to page 320, beginning of Sheni, out of nowhere, seemingly cutting in between the action completely, what do we have? Ele Roshe Bet Avotam. These are the heads of the houses. Bnei Reuven, Bechor Yisrael, Chanoch, Ufalu. And you just need to skim through these, verse after verse after verse of family tree, telling you all about who is this boy? Who is this man standing before Pharaoh? Who is Moshe? Where does he come from? Who is his father, his grandfather, his great-grandfather? Who married who? So everyone see that this is what you would expect to appear where? In chapter 2, right? But there, what have you got? Just darkness. Ish, Bat Levi, no names whatsoever. Where do all the names appear? I haven't counted the names, but, you know, dozens of names. Where do they appear? We have to wait until chapter 6 in order for them to appear. So just to sum up this little thought, the name Shemot is not just the first significant word that appears in the book of Shemot. It captures one of the critical themes that the book of Shemot is about: a proud family, the beginnings of a proud people, with a proud history, a proud past, and a proud identity, who under the terrible weight of slavery come very, very close to losing that identity. And the story of Shemot is how they both regain and recapture and flourish with that identity. So it's Shemot, it's the loss of Shemot, and then the regaining of Shemot again. Okay, and you can just see it in that very simple progression between chapter 1, first verses, lots of names. Chapter 2, the death, the absence of any names. Emerging back into chapter 6 as the story gets going and we begin to recapture some of the names. Okay, that is my thoughts on the name Shemot. Any questions or thoughts? Geffen, did you have your hand up?
Where Moshe kills the Egyptian. Isn't that also a place where like Moshe chooses like, his identity?
That's interesting. Yeah.
It's interesting that it's...
So to project it forward a few weeks, what is the lineage list really doing there at that point is just like actually the most fascinating question. And lineage lists are the things that normally you think, oh my gosh, these are the most boring verses ever, right? I can go to sleep for Shani and then wake up a few minutes later. I promise you, this lineage list is the most exciting thing, right? Once you actually get down to it, what is the lineage list doing there? You'll be on the edge of your seats, I hope. That's almost a prediction. Okay, what's the English name for the book?
Exodus,
interesting, right? Exodus is not a translation of Shemot. Exodus is definitely not a translation of Chumash Sheni. What does Exodus mean? What's it referencing?
Yitzhak
Mitzrayim, right? So what does the word Exodus, I don't know who, I assume it was a Christian author, what does the name Exodus say about the book? What is it saying is sort of like the critical idea of the book? Right, exactly. Right. What is Sefer Shemot? What is the book of Exodus about? It's about the exit. It's about the exodus of the Jews from Egypt. Now that's really interesting, right? Because what is it sort of saying? The critical fact of the book of Shemot is Yitziat Mitzrayim. Why is that sort of a problem? I don't mean a problem in terms of like a religious problem. Why is it a problem from the point of view of learning the book? Very good, Megan. So if you look at the source sheet where I put structure and content of Sefer Shemot, I just put three bullet points on the left-hand side, right? This is the structure of the book. Chapter 1 to chapter 15 describes the slavery, and Moshe and Aaron's attempts to release Israel, and with the plagues, and eventually chapter 15, Am Yisrael have left. Very, very good. Critical story, very important story, obviously. But look, I've still got 25 chapters left. Right, the book isn't even halfway, and the Jews have already left Egypt. Right, so the name Exodus puts a huge amount of weight on the first, I mean, just over a third of the book. But that sort of then implies that anything that comes after the first 15 chapters, that's not particularly important, right? Or that's not the core idea. Pinchas?
How is Shemot better than that?
Because the way in which I understand, if you say it's just the first word, then it's just the first word. Because I think that's capturing an overall theme, which is sort of more abstract. It's not talking about a specific event. It's talking about the nature of their identity. But maybe let's get to that. There is one more name that is given to the book of Shemot, which we haven't discussed. We've said Chumash Sheni, we've said Shemot, we have said Exodus. There's one more name, which is a very, very interesting name. Anybody familiar with what that name is? This is a name which, as far as I know, is given by the Ramban, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, not earlier than him, as far as I know. And in fact, when I went back and read him, it's on the source sheet, he doesn't even actually say it. Yeah. Very good, very good. He himself doesn't really say it, but he doesn't use those words, Sefer HaGeulah. But it's very clear this is what he's talking about. Sefer HaGeulah, which means the Book of
Redemption.
Redemption. Now, you could listen to that, Book of Redemption. You say, so what? What's the great revolution in the word redemption? Sounds very similar to Exodus, right? We were redeemed from slavery, right? Ga'al otanu, right? The way in which the Ramban is going to spin it is to see that, in fact, it's really not about that at all. Here is the Ramban, okay? Watch this. Sefer Ve'ele Shemot be'inyan ha'galut ha'rishon ha'nigzar be'perush u'be'gu'ula mimen. The book of Shemot is about this first galut, this first exile, and the ge'ula, and the redemption from it. Now, at what point is the exile over and the redemption begun? And here is his critical reading. V'hine, ha'galut enenu nishlam ad yom shuvam el makomam. The galut is not over, is not completed until they, meaning Israel, return to their place. Vel ma'alat avotam yashuvu, and to return to the place of their fathers, to the place from which they were exiled. Uchshiyatsu mimitzrayim, and when they left Egypt, af al pi shiyatsu mibeit havadim, even though they had left the house of slavery, adayin yachshavu golim, they were still to be considered as golim, as exiled. Ki bahayu ba'aretz lo lahem, they were in a land which was not theirs. Nevuchim bamidbar, confused, confounded in the desert. Uchshabau el har Sinai. It's interesting, at this point you're thinking, so when is it over? It's over when they get to
Israel.
That's what it sounds like, he's going to say. He seems to then go in a slightly different direction. Uchshabau el har Sinai, when they come to Sinai. Vasu hamishkan, I make the mishkan. Vashav hakadosh baruch hu, and return, God came to them and placed his Shechinah, his presence amongst them. As nechshavu geulim, at that point are they considered redeemed. And for this reason does the book finish with the story, the very, very detailed construction of the Mishkan, and with Hashem's presence filling it. And what this piece does, very simply, is to say the whole book, right? Just look back at those three bullet points. Not just chapter 1 to 15, the story of the Exodus, but chapter 1 to 40, the Exodus, Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah, and the building of the Mishkan, the Tabernacle. All of those are events which are critical to the whole theme of the book. The theme of the book is Ge'ulah, is redemption, but not just physical redemption from the slavery, but rather the story continues. It continues to Har Sinai, and it continues to the Mishkan. Anybody want to share any sort of thoughts or responses on this, as to what sort of is the core idea here?
The calling it Exodus is very much like coming from, and calling it Sefer Gula is very much going to, or going towards. So in calling it the Gula, it's the focus on what the entire Exodus and what that process was moving towards versus just where we're coming from.
Yofi. Very good. Thank you, Micah.
Yeah, it's like a spiritual redemption and also just a physical redemption. So when talking about Shmuel, like you were at the beginning as an identity factor, it's more of your identity is not just wrapped up in where you are, it's who you are.
Yofi, very okay. People ready for some serious philosophy? Won't take more than a few minutes, but ready for some philosophy which you can pull out of your pocket at any point and impress people with, right? This is a core, I think, philosophical idea and specifically political philosophy. Okay, coined by a man called Sir Isaiah Berlin, passed away in the 1990s, a Jew born in Riga in Latvia. Fled communism as a young child with his family, arrived in London, went to school with my great uncle in London, and then went to Oxford and stayed at Oxford, became one of the most important philosophers of the 20th century. And he, one of his most famous works, and he was very, very involved in sort of the arguments against communism and fascism, one of his most famous ideas is what he called two concepts of liberty. Two types of freedom, okay? There is what he called positive freedom and negative freedom, okay? That doesn't mean good freedom and bad freedom. It doesn't mean that at all, right? It means positive freedom and negative freedom. Let's start with negative freedom. Negative freedom means the absence of any constraints on my action, right? If you were to ask for a definition of freedom, what's sort of like a very simple definition that people would say? Free to do whatever you want, what I want to do, when I want to do it, without anybody telling me what I want to do. Okay? That is negative freedom. Nobody is stopping me from doing anything. No state, no teachers, no police, no parents, right? These are things that would stop me from doing what I want. Positive freedom is actually things, the presence of things, which forces my actions in a certain way. I'm not free to choose, but rather it directs me in a certain way, which allows me to live my life on a level which I would not be able to do if that sort of that object, as it were, was not there guiding my action. That positive freedom actually limits my ability to choose, but allows me to raise my life to a higher level than would be possible without it. So just to give it like a very, very simple example, maybe it's so simple it'll sound stupid, but hopefully it'll capture it. Traffic lights, right? Is that an infringement on your freedom, or does it actually contribute to your freedom? Answer?
Contribute.
It depends, right? According to negative freedom, it's literally stopping you from going when you want to go, right? You are not allowed to drive, right? That, now, it might be a necessary infringement on my liberty, but it's something which is still a curtailment of my liberty. But according to positive freedom, obviously, you know, a society which has cars but doesn't have traffic lights is, you know, not going to go very far. And the traffic light allows us to live our life on a higher level. Okay, I'll give a better example, showing how this is such a political idea. I just know it from British history. In the, I think, the mid-19th century, the British government made it compulsory for every child to attend school until the age of 11. Many families, thousands of families across the country were furious, right? Because the child, from the age of being five, is somebody who is able to earn money, able to go out, whether it be down the mine, whether it be in a shop, and is able to contribute to putting bread on the family table. Right? So which way do you look at it? From the point of view of negative liberty, these families are completely right. The government is not allowing them to be able to use their family to be able to make wealth. But from the point of view of positive liberty, of the idea of having an educated country, of an educated workforce who over the long term will allow the country to live their lives on a much higher level, obviously this is a great enhancement of their liberty. I want to say, as it were, and I think this is a very good guiding idea, the machloket between the argument of whether you call this book, which we are learning, the book of Exodus, or Sefer HaGeula, the book of redemption, as the Ramban reads it, is exactly this argument. Meaning, what is the core idea of Sefer Shemot? Is it the fact that we are no longer slaves, negative liberty? Or is it the fact that we are able to commit ourselves and our lives to a vision, to an idea, which allows us to live our lives on a much higher level, which is Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah, and the Mishkan, what that captures? To put it all very, very simply, this is the way Isaiah Berlin sums it up. Is it freedom from, or is it freedom to? Right? When we think of liberty, is it about being free from slavery, oppression, the Egyptians, etc.? Or is it about freedom to commit our lives to an idea greater than ourselves?
Don't they go hand in hand?
I think they definitely do go hand in hand.
It's both. It's they have freedom from the Egyptians, so that they have the freedom to go towards Hashem. I mean, there's all these Mefarshim who say, you know, things like we're not really done being slaves, we're slaves to Hashem now, and it's something else, and they're putting that energy somewhere else. You know, to me it just sounds like the difference between anarchy and government.
I don't think you should... I mean, you're not wrong in that, yes, they certainly contribute to one another, but you shouldn't underplay the differences so much.
No, they definitely do have differences, so they are differences, but doesn't one automatically kind of lead to the other?
If it doesn't lead to the other,
you have chaos.
Not necessarily.
How not necessarily?
Okay, maybe the traffic light example was a bit of a silly one.
In that example, but if you're free from being oppressed... You become free from being a slave. Then what?
I think you would find many people, maybe not the people around in this room, but I think you would find many people who say that their Jewish identity is about a commitment to social justice, is about understanding that because of our history, we should be sensitive to the experiences of others, and saying that, however, sort of the religious element of Judaism does not speak to me so much, which you could very much see as a saying of what is the most important story in Shemot for me. It's a story of Yitzhak Mitzrayim. What would I call this book? I would call this book Exodus. An alternative approach is to say that whilst that is true, Exodus is not worth anything, or it's not worth much if it doesn't lead to Matan Torah, right? If it doesn't lead to some...
Right, with that argument, I mean, traditional Judaism wouldn't have existed if people didn't start by keeping the laws and passing it down.
That's a good argument to make, but this is a very, very critical difference as to... And, I mean, we're going to sort of develop this idea more as we go. Is the major idea of the book a political idea, or is it a religious idea? That's going to be something that sticks with us. Just to finish, I want to do a little bit of sort of learning of the first chapter. What I want you to do is I want you to read the verses 8, Pasuk Chet, we're back in chapter 1, to chapter 2, Pasuk, to verse 14, Pasuk Yud Dalet. And what I want you to ask yourself is, does it remind you of any other story elsewhere in the Tanakh? And maybe I'll make it a bit simpler for you. Does it remind you of any other story that we've already covered in the Torah? Right, an earlier story. Okay, so just the first chapter of Shemot, verses 8 to 14. Read it with a chavruta, read it with a person next to you, and... see if there are any parts in it which sort of trigger reflections or memories of some other earlier story.
Michael,
Pasuk Yud Dalet.
Outsmart. Yeah, we gotta beat them up. Any of that, lest they get hurt. I got each grabbing up our own side. I'm not going to even have a line of lock down. Lest they get hurt. Why not?
Good. 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Let's deal with him before.
Okay, when asking for the connection, I want you to think both of a thematic connection and also of specific words. Words which come up here, which trigger something else. Okay, what are our... Well, Gabe says he's got a couple of creative ones. I want to hear them first. What have you got?
We were thinking Yaakov and Lavan was one.
Okay.
And Lavan makes his life...
Okay.
And Yosef on Mitzrayim.
Why, what's the Yosef? I mean, Yosef's connection to Mitzvah. Okay, very good. I wasn't thinking of those. Yeah, Daphne?
Also a creative one, Sarah throwing out Hagar.
Go on.
Because Hagar had Ishmael with Abraham, and then eventually Sarah had Yitzhak, Sarah sees Hagar, and then she says to Abraham, Beresha, I might as well, throw her out, kind of like throwing out the Jews, making them sin.
Okay. Other stories, suggestions? Avi?
Yosef and his brothers.
That's the one that you've got? That's it?
Well,
that's the correct one?
Did
they throw him out?
Yo, so Yosef and his brothers, when Yosef's born, it's like not by the mouth, but like they change their mind of their mindset towards like their family, and then their minds, they want to get rid of him, so they're like try to do all these things like what Paro's doing, but they're just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Yosef's getting bigger and bigger, just as B'nai Yisrael getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, lovely idea. Very nice. No. Come on, I want one story, one very clear story. It's definitely it.
So I don't know, this isn't that clear, but the story of Adam when he eats from the tree of knowledge.
Go on.
And then it's like the same thing, like he's really knowledgeable, like whatever, Hashem's a little nervous, and then he has to work the land.
Okay, that's interesting. And then I guess you've got Peru Revu as well in there. I wasn't thinking of that. You go?
We can say... Migdal Babel.
Thank you. Obviously, Migdal Babel. Very good. Without a doubt, it's Migdal Babel. Yigal, why is it Migdal Babel?
I was gonna say because they were kind of scared of God being so overpowering of everything, so they wanted to build a tower and suppress that.
There you're going with Midrash, but what's the? Okay, that's the fear.
Yeah.
Clear in the text, right? The most obvious thing is, unlike all the other stories that people have mentioned. Got stories of building a city. Right? Here, in... Everyone turns to page 48, by the way. Bereshit Perek Yud Aleph. Right? In Shemot, the Jews are put to building Pitom and Ramses. The story of Migdal Babel is about the story of the building of a city. Right?
I don't like this.
It must be you don't like it. You haven't heard it yet. Okay? The city is the thematic connection, okay? Everybody listen to this. We read in Shemot that that Paros says, Hava nitchakma lo. Let us deal wisely with them. Pen yirbe, lest they become great, etc., etc. And what do we read in Bereshit Perek Yud Aleph? Pasuk Dalad Vayomru. And they say, Hava, come, let us. Nivne lanu ir, we'll build a city, Migdal v'roshob b'shamayim, with a great tower. Naaseh lanu shem, we'll make for ourselves a name. Pen nafots, lest we spread out, al panei kol ha'aretz. How many times in Tanakh do the words Hava and pen, let us and lest, appear together? Any guesses?
What?
Pinchas is on the money. Exactly, twice, right? Twice in all of Tanakh. Anybody know where? Oh my, yes, very good.
What
Bereshit. Yeah, almost. there we go, right? And by that, they've also got the same gematria, right? In both times, right? I thought you'd like that one, Michael. Right? That is the first one. What any other textual connections that you saw in it? What? Right, very good. They're as they're growing. That's another one. That's a very, very clear one. Yes. The bricks. What do we have in the bricks?
Chomer
ulevanim and levena and chomer. Right, exactly the same materials used both times. Used in order to make bricks. Very, very good. All right. So what? Right? That is always the question you then need to ask. You've got a connection, right? You've got a thematic connection, the building of cities. You've got linguistic connections, pen, hava, chomer, levenim. What does it mean? What is the significance of the parallel? Okay, this is the question you always need to ask with biblical parallels. Two ideas. The first one is a very, very basic one. Okay? But I think it's actually a very, very profound one. Sefer Bereshit, beginning with Adam and Noach, is in the... then focuses on Migdal Bavel. What is the story immediately after Migdal Bavel? Abraham, right? The Jewish story, as it were, starts with Abraham, starts immediately with post-Migdal Bavel. Where is Abraham from? From the same part of the world as Migdal Bavel. Where does he then go? He goes, next chapter, Lech Lecha, goes to the land of Israel. In other words, you can look at all of Sefer Bereshit as a turning away from the East, as a moving away from the culture of Mesopotamia and going Lech Lecha El Ha'aretz, going on this journey to Eretz Yisrael. Sefer Shemot begins in which country? Mitzrayim, Egypt. We have exactly this similar story, all of the connections, and the whole story is once again about going on a journey, but this time not from east to west, but from west to east, right? In other words, Sefer Shemot is a turning away from the west to the east. In both cases, the destination is the same. The destination is Eretz Yisrael, right? The great theme, really, in many ways, of the Tanakh as a whole, is that Eretz Yisrael is this tiny little strip of land, right? Bein ha-nahar ha-gadol mitzvahayim ad nahar prat, between the great, between the river of Egypt, the Nile, and the great river of the Euphrates, in between these two great civilizations, which are essentially the beginning of human history, Egypt and Mesopotamia, and Eretz Yisrael as being both geographically in between them, but also from the point of view of the whole idea of the Torah as being separated from them. So Avraham moves from east to west in Bereshit, and Am Yisrael moved from west to east in Shemot. I think that's the basic meaning of the parallel, and so therefore we put at the beginning of Shemot this reference back to Migdal Bavel, which is the turning away. I think that's a yesod, I think it's a real fundamental, I think it's really interesting. There is, however, another reading of it. What's the tower about? What is the sin of the people who build the tower? Answer, 101 answers, right? The text is not clear, so we have many, many different ones. Yagar quoted Midrash about waging war against heaven. I'm going to very quickly, and we'll finish with this idea, share the Netziv's idea. Netziv Rabbi Nosson Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, in his commentary... very good, exactly what we're going to come to. Says the Netziv, I just put the text in front of you, but I'll just say the idea over. The Hebrew is shockingly not on the Bar-Ilan program. The sin of Migdal Babel, of the Tower of Babel, was this desire for unity and conformity on everybody's part. How does the story start? Vayihi kol ha'aretz, safa achat udvarim achadim, and the whole land was of a single tongue and of one common purpose. And this becomes their overall idea, that there shall be no differentiation, no distinctions amongst anybody. They want the whole society to be united. Says the Netziv, that is exactly what the Torah does not want. The Torah thinks the world should not be one monochromatic, no difference between people. The Torah thinks the world should be divided into different nations. It should be diverse. It should not insist on the uniformity throughout. They do not want anybody to spread away. And when did the Netziv live? Anybody? 20th century, right? So you don't have to think too hard about what he means, what he's thinking of by the following. What's the role of the tower? Yeah. Everyone see how scary that is? The tower isn't like a beautiful, lovely sort of attraction. The tower is a watchtower. That's the way in which the Netziv reads it. You can look at it in front of you. To check that nobody disperses. To check that nobody thinks differently. And if they do, we kill them. And if you live in the age of Auschwitz, or if you live in the age of the Gulag, as the Netziv, who passed away shortly before that, but he saw the beginnings of totalitarianism. That is the terrifying view of what Migdal Babel is. It's the suppression of the individual and the demanding of absolute uniformity, right? And notice that what happened just before Migdal Babel was a whole lovely long list of names, right? We had names, identity, and those names all disappear in Migdal Babel. There are no names in Migdal Babel, and Avraham is the response to that. What do we have in Shemot? Exactly the same idea. What is it that the Egyptians try to place upon the Jews? The suppression of any identity, any idea difference from them, as we've already spoken about today. No names are there whatsoever, until Avi said that the first name in Shemot is Moshe's name, but it's not. Who is the first name in Shemot? Sorry? Sorry, but as an after the list of names at the beginning, before Miriam, before Yocheved, they're not mentioned. Shifra and Puah, when do they come? Exactly afterwards, right? I said to read up to and including verse 14, verse 15, if you're not back there, page 294. Vayomer melech Mitzrayim le'adot ha'ivriyot, asher shem ha'echat Shifra, v'shem ha'sheinit Puah. Said the king of Egypt to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was called Shifra, one of whom was called Puah. We're not even told the name of the king of Egypt, but we are given their names. He says to them, kill the baby boys when they are born. V'tirena ha'meledet et ha'olohim, they fear God. V'lo asu, they do not do it, right? And they keep them alive, right? It is these women who are given names, who are the first people to stand up to this tyranny, right? A very similar tyranny to that of Migdal Babel. And they make possible both the continuation, literally alive, of the Jewish people and of the story. Let's just finish with this. This is by a woman called Judy Klitzner, who's written a lovely book on sequels, as she calls them in the Bible, linked stories. And she has this lovely chapter on the story of the midwives and Migdal Babel. We'll finish with this. In a culture without names, these women are named. In a world bereft of God's presence, they find God, fear him, and lay the foundation for his active engagement with his people. In a civilization in which silent, at times lethal acquiescence to authority is the rule, the midwives protest Pharaoh's command with their act of defiance. When contrasted with the characterless society of Babel, these women appear all the more extraordinary. If Babel warns of the dangers of a society that fails to confront itself, the courageous midwives who challenge convention serve as the Bible's retort to that failed generation. In Babel, the individual is blotted out, and as a result, so is the entire generation. In the story's subversive sequel, the enslavement in Egypt, the individual is seriously corroded, but two distinctive women arrive in time to reverse the process. Shifra and Puah set off a chain of events that will ultimately lead to the defeat of the tyrannical Egyptian regime and to the salvation of the Israelite nation. While the builders at Babel see their efforts end in ruin and rubble, the story of the midwives concludes with a reconstruction of the broken household of Israel. The outstanding women of Exodus undermine the Babel narrative to such an extent that in their story, the only structure to come crashing down is the textual account of uniformity, oppression, and godlessness. Shakar, everybody. Lovely beginning Shemot with you. Next week we meet, obviously, our hero, and that is Moshe. Have a wonderful week, everyone.
Thank you.
How do I pause this?
You gotta open it.
Yeah. Catherine, only you can end recording.
So much power in there.